Welcome to you once again. If you listen to the ARD old station or 257 new station every Sunday morning for the past couple of years, you will be familiar with the voice of Mr. Tony Boylan. Mr. Tony Boylan is my very special guest this evening. He's a man who has, in actual fact, been one of the pioneers of radio in this country. Good evening, Tony. How are you?
Good evening, Eric. I'm very well, thank you.
Good. Now, I, of course, was unaware recently that you had been one of the pioneers of radio, so tell me how you got involved in the first place.
Well, Eric, I suppose it is a long story. My first involvement in pirate radio, actually I prefer the term
commercial.
Yes. I go, Eric, it's way back to 1945.
Yes.
And at that time, World War II was coming to a close. And to have a transmitter at that time was an impossibility because there just wasn't such a thing around. Even the amateur stations who were legalized before the war had no license to operate during the war years because of the possibility of communicating with the enemy was always there. So I decided it was time to start a small local station. And my father was in the army at the time, and I got hold of a good engineer who gave me a circuit of a small transmitter, which I put together myself, and it was a battery-operated transmitter. And it had two valves and a very Heath Robinson affair it was too, operating on a low voltage of for the valves of 2 volts, one of those old accumulators they used to use for the old battery radios, which power the heaters and the valves. And the high tension was derived from a never ready type high tension battery of 150 volts. So I got it built after many weeks of fiddling around, and I finally came on the air with it. And I used a frequency of 196 metres and had a range of 4 miles. And it was very successful because, being a battery-operated job, the signal was very clear. There was no possibility of hum occurring, which can happen with the mains operated equipment very easy. But my father got to hear the thing, and of course, I was nearly put out of the house.
He's a rebel.
In the army, of course, it was deadly. He maintained that he could be accused of collaborating with the enemy or communicating with them. So he told me either it or I would have to go.
Yeah.
So the transmitter had to go.
Yeah.
But what I did, in fact, was I hid it under the floorboards.
Well, was it? Were you the first one to start a station like that in the country?
I was the very first, to my knowledge, to have the first local station operating in Dublin.
Yeah.
On the music scene, that is.
Now, and did you have a particular name on the station when you started?
Yes. At the time, I lived in Rathmines in a little cul-de-sac road called Killeen Road. And I christened the station right away the Killeen Home Service.
Yes.
And of course, we only operated on a Sunday morning for an hour, for fear that P&T would get wind of it.
Yeah.
And we used to get lots of requests from all the neighbours pushed in the letterbox from Saturday night onwards.
Now, when you started the station, did you go around telling people that you'd started the station?
I did.
And so forth?
Yes.
Yeah.
Friends and neighbours alike.
Yeah. And then I suppose then it was sort of word of mouth built it up.
Yes.
Did it?
They spread their gospel around quite quickly.
And would you say you had a very big listenership, yeah?
Well, I ended up with the Killeen Home Service with having, I'd say, probably about 300 listeners.
Yes, go ahead.
At that time, I suppose it wasn't too bad because I was short range of 4 miles. And I learned one day that I had a friend of mine in the Cork Street Hospital who picked up the broadcast and was very much surprised this particular Sunday morning.
Yeah.
So they were there in the hospital as a patient for some time, and they went on listening each Sunday morning.
So right, you started the station. How many hours did you do from the beginning?
Just 1 hour each Sunday.
Yeah, and that was what? Based on what type of show?
It was based on a mixed bag, as all the other preceding stations were. Mainly listeners' requests, and if I hadn't got enough requests, I always put in what I thought would be suitable myself.
Yeah.
From
yeah.
a library which I had built up at that time.
Now, were you an avid, say, listener to, obviously you were, to stations like BBC and so forth before this?
Yes, I was always a great radio listener all during the war years.
Yeah, yeah. And in those days, of course, I mean, would you say there were difficulties with the P&T regarding, you know, was it overlooked?
Well, it was completely overlooked when I was operating at that particular address. I never had any interference from the PNT, possibly because of the short range of the station.
You never had your door broken down?
No. I think 4 miles was about its maximum transmission.
Yes. Now, from there, what was the next move after that, then?
Well, after that, we went on there to operate until 1951, when we moved house to Ballymun. And just an ordinary house in Ballymun, I set up station once again, and we renamed the station Radio 200. This time, using the same transmitter, and we had a whole new listening public from there. And all the neighbours in that area, Ballymun, Santry, and Moby Road, they all got wind of the word, and we got lots of requests all the time.
So you had quite a big audience, isn't it?
Oh, when I got to Ballymun.
Yeah, and the same once again, an hour every Sunday.
The very same, every Sunday morning, 1 hour, generally 12 to 1 p.m.
Yeah, and did you say at a later stage then increase the amount of hours, or were you more ambitious later on, or how did that come up?
Well, later on, we did acquire a better transmitter, but not during the Ballymun days. We operated in Ballymun from 1951 until 1955, when I moved to Santry.
So you started another one then?
So we started a bigger one in Santry.
So what was that called?
Well, this was called Radio Galaxy.
Yeah.
And we changed the frequency once again, mainly because it was a crystal-controlled transmitter, whereas the previous one was VFO. In other words, you could operate any frequency was between 200 and 500 meters.
Yeah. Go ahead.
The crystal-controlled job was a much better transmitter. It was a 40-watt output transmitter. And I had listening public in Bray, Dunleary, Baldoyle, Skerries, Balbriggan, and all those areas. We had 30 miles approximately of range.
Yes.
Which, I suppose, wasn't bad for 40 watts.
Yes, I mean there are many of these local stations now probably don't even cover as far as that, do they?
Well, it really depends on the aerial. I had a fairly good aerial at the time. And really a transmitter is only as good as its aerial.
Yeah. Now, you operated at a station, but did you operate in any other way? You know, the radio system where you could talk to people, ham radio, isn't this what it was called?
Ham radio, no, I never went into ham radio at all. In fact, I never had an interest in making contacts with just speech only, which you could only do with ham radio operation.
Yes.
I was always only interested in broadcasting musical programmes.
What motivated you to start in the first place, then?
Well, I suppose what motivated me, I had built up quite a collection of records at that time. And I thought, well, here is the only way to use them, to broadcast them and give pleasure to other people.
Were you, did it take long, say, to decide that you would start a station, or were you...
Well, I thought it was many years before 1945, but the war was so much involved at that time, even to get parts to do the job wasn't possible. And it took me quite a time to get hold of a good radio engineer that could construct a circuit, even to build a battery transmitter. That would operate with a reasonably good signal without distortion.
And how long did Galaxy, say, continue then, up to when?
Well, Galaxy continued right up to 1965, and we renamed the station in 1965. We renamed the station, it was a must to rename it. We renamed it Radio Laxy.
Why was that?
At that time, we started to have problems with the PNT.
Yes.
They came.
Yeah.
And that meant that I had to go off the air for many months.
Yeah.
So, I did go off the air, but
you were a wanted man.
I was a wanted man, yes. Well, they came one Sunday morning in the middle of the programme.
Yeah.
And mind you, I got a tip off from a very good friend that they would be coming, but I only half believed it.
Well, one of those things that'll never happen to me, I suppose, would it, yeah?
I always thought it would. I always hoped it wouldn't. But they came, and I half expected them, so I was watching.
Yeah.
So they came, but I just didn't admit them.
Yeah.
So they didn't, they went away eventually after about 20 minutes of pounding on the door, because they got the signal right to the door. They could see the aerial, they could see the down lead from it, and they knew that they were in the right spot. But they didn't bring any support with them, like the guards or anything like that, so they had to go away eventually.
Yeah.
So I went off the air for, I think, about 6 months at that time, Eric.
Did that make you nervous or more determined to carry on?
Well, I thought, well, I'll leave it for about 6 months, then I'll go back on and I'll rename the station and I'll change the day. I was fooling nobody but myself, of course. So I did go back about 6 months later, and I called it Radio Laxy, and I changed it to a Saturday operating time 1 to 2, and the frequency was the same, 217 meters.
Yes.
So I went on 1965 when I kept going, and peculiar enough, I didn't have any further problems with the P&T.
Maybe because it didn't work in a sanity.
Well, maybe they didn't. I never thought of that one.
Yeah.
So that was, Radio Laxey went on until 1978, until I ended at that time because I changed completely over to the previous station, ARD.
Yes. You continued the same type of show altogether on ARD right throughout, didn't you?
Well, it was really the same type of show, always a mixed bag with requests and competitions, etc.
And going back after all those years, would you say you've got many listeners that have been listening for many, many years?
Well, I have, yes. I've listeners that have been with me really back to 1951.
It's a long time,
yeah.
Isn't it? Yeah. So they've come along with you all the way.
Absolutely, and these particular people, they set their alarm clocks on a Sunday morning.
Yeah.
Especially when the show used to be 8 to 9, so that they wouldn't oversleep it and miss it.
And you've always, has it always been called the 78 show, or has this been in recent years?
No, the 78 show only started when we went over to ARD.
Yes. Whose idea was this? Was your idea yourself?
Yes, it was my idea to call it the 78 show.
Yeah. Now, I'll tell you what, we know you've got a very big collection of records, and we'll come back to that in a moment, but I'd like you to play one of yours now, and perhaps you'll introduce the first one and give any background that there is to it.
Yes, certainly. Well, a particular favourite of mine, and it's by the late John McCormack, and this particular record, I've always liked it because I always thought it was one of John's best-loved records, really. The title is Lovely Dearest.
Okay, well, we'll play that specially for you.
Okay, Eric, thank you. It is. They have about 500 members at the moment.
It's quite a lot, really, isn't it?
And they do an annual big recital in the Gresham Hotel, and then invite celebrities like maybe Canon Sidney McEwan or somebody big in the singing world over.
Yes.
Or maybe Brendan O'Dowda, various people like that. And it turns out to be a very fine night always. Well worth going to.
What was the reputation of John McCormack outside of Ireland?
Well, there's a lot of mixed opinions about the great John McCormack. You know, he spent a great portion of his life in America, touring. And a lot of people I've heard people say John McCormack was a very mean man. But in fact, John McCormack was a very generous man.
Why did he say he was a mean man?
Because a lot of people think that when he left Ireland, he was all out to make big money for himself. Well, in fact, from America, he sent big contributions back to this country for various charities.
Which probably nobody knew about.
Nobody knew about. And John didn't make a big thing about publicising the fact that he did so.
Mm.
He was a very charitable man, in fact, John McCormack.
And how successful was he in say, America?
Tremendously successful in America. He did a tremendous amount of opera in America, and he could sing in, I think, about 6-7 languages. He was a very versatile man. Some people think he was only involved with singing ballads. But John McCormack could sing practically any song.
Yes.
Ballads, any song, operatic or light classical songs. He was very versatile.
Go ahead.
Of course, most people know he was born here in Ireland, in Athlone. And really, he died... Well, he wasn't old by any means when he died. He died in 1945.
What age was he then?
He was about, he was about 65 when he died.
Yes, which isn't old.
Not at all, no.
No. And how many of his records would you have, say, in your library?
Well, in my library, I would probably have the titles. I probably would have about 250 titles of John's works. And, you know, he made over 500 commercial recordings during his lifespan. And then he made many other private recordings that were never issued.
So you only have half the amount of the actual name?
Oh, indeed. I wouldn't even have half, no.
And I'm sure many of these are probably collector's items now as well.
Oh, some of them are indeed, yes. Some of those records he made that he actually signed the actual record with a nib pen.
Yes.
And others were signed in the wax, you know, in the pressing that came out in the wax.
Yes.
And then he made lots of single-sided recordings, which today are quite valuable, sir, to put particular stuff on them.
And did you ever get to see him?
No, I was never fortunate enough to see him.
Yeah. Well, what age did he go to live in America at?
Well, he left Ireland, as I see now. What age would he have been? He was a very young man when he left. I'd say he was about 25 when he left to go to America.
Did he go there like many to seek his fortune, or did he apply to there?
Yes.
And did he make his fortune there?
Oh, he did, yes. I mean, this country, being a small country, with all good artists, I mean, there isn't a great scope here for them.
Do you even consider that nowadays as well?
I do, yes.
Yeah. Would you think it's the fault of the country, or do you think that there just isn't enough thought of these artists?
No, these artists do not get enough opportunities to sing in public. Like today, we have the television media, we have two channels here, and radio. And there are great people going around here in Dublin today, and they do not get enough opportunity to appear on television or sing. They've got to go away. It's a total pity, I
think. Like the old saying, the profit is appreciated
elsewhere, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, touring is big business for these people, and they really build up a tremendous name for themselves by touring.
Yeah. I know I'm most surprised in meeting some of these people that, you know, they're Irish and they live here, and you don't hear much of them here, and yet outside the country they seem to make a better living.
They do. That seems to be the case with most people, apart from John McCormack.
Yes. In the style of singing of John McCormack, who else would you class as your favourites in that line of music?
Well, I'm very fond of tenors. Another very great tenor that he's deceased now is Richard Crooks.
Yes.
And of course, he was an American tenor, and he was one of America's favourite tenors. And he made a tremendous amount of recordings in his lifetime too. Nothing as much as John McCormack, of course, but he made many hundreds of records.
In the modern era now, we've got a different type of music. How do you feel that these people, their music goes down? Do you think they will continue to sort of become, shall we say, in the Hall of Fame and continued success and continued, say, following with people? Or do you think they will die out eventually? What do you think?
Do you mean the modern thing as we have
say the likes of John McCormack now, say now, I mean, there are a lot of people who are, as you say, in the society, and we've moved into a different age of music. How do you see, say, the likes of people who are interested in that type of singing following, say, John McCormack 20 years time? Do you still think there will be a growth there for
I do, Eric. I don't think they will ever lose their listening appeal at all. I think that John McCormack and such people will still be around in the next 30, 40, 50 years from now.
Yes. So you think their popularity will increase rather than decrease?
I think so, yes. Because when you look at these great people, John McCormack, Richard Crooks, etc., Geely, they're all gone now. They have never been replaced. And we don't seem to have anybody nowadays that can replace them.
Yes.
I don't know if it's a case of somebody not wanting to replace them, because there may not be the great demand there is for these people today that we had way back in the 30s.
Perhaps the last great singer of that sort of singing is probably Mario Lanza, I suppose, isn't it?
Well, Mario Lanza was about the best I've heard, I would think, since most of these people have died. Yes, I would think Mario Lanza was. He was an up-and-coming great tenor, but they didn't credit, because he came up too fast in the business. All these other great singers, they trained in Italy and such places and spent a great deal of their earlier years in very, very hectic training.
Yes.
You know, they just didn't get to the top as quickly as Mario Lanza did. I mean, he came there really I won't say overnight, but in a very short time.
Would you say this success of his was a downfall in the long run? He came too quick and...
Yes, it could well be. His fame maybe went to his head. I mean, unfortunately, he drank a lot and he didn't look after himself.
Well, he ate enormous amounts.
Oh, he did. Tremendously. He had a tremendous appetite for both food and drink. And I mean, he couldn't possibly carry on with the singing career the way he should have done.
He was a very young man when he died.
Oh, of course, indeed. He wrecked his life. I mean, he had tremendous potential.
What age was he when he died?
I think he died, I think he was only 30, 35 or something like that.
Yeah. So his talent really gone.
Absolutely. He was at the top of his career at the time. At that time.
And I mean, he must have made an enormous amount of money. I mean, the amount of films he made and...
He did. Well, when they picked him to play the part of the great Caruso, which today Caruso is still billed as the world's greatest tenor, even though Caruso is dead such a long time, he's still known as the greatest tenor today. And we have the great Luciano Pavarotti, the great Italian tenor. He played in Dublin not so very long ago in the Gaiety. Now, a lot of people today say Pavarotti is the world's greatest tenor now. Well, it's a matter of opinion, really. Pavarotti is tremendous, but Caruso, I mean, has held the post for a great many years, when you think of it.
Probably different eras, isn't it? It's like
probably
boxing
different
and
eras,
sports, yeah. But in comparison, how would you compare, like, Mario Lanza to Caruso, then?
Well, you see, it's very hard to say. Caruso, during Caruso's career, there was no such thing as electrically recording available, and it was all the old acoustical method used. So you didn't get quality, but the voice was there. The voice always came true. And, I mean, Mario Lanza today, up to the time he died, he had all the modern techniques available to him. And he had everything to help him. Whereas Caruso, at that during his career, it was absolutely voice only he was working on. He had no mechanical aids. Mario Lanza or other people of today. There's everything going for them.
Why is it that the Italians seem to... Sorry, you were going to say something that time, Tori?
No, I was just going to say that I always think it's much easier to record nowadays for any singer, because they have every mechanical device there for them. They're all this multi-track recording, and they make umpteen tapes, and they edit them, and they pick out the best bits, and they put them all together.
So what we really hear most times is we don't really hear the real thing, do we?
You very seldom hear the complete work right through at first attempt. You know, in Caruso's early days, there was also thing as a microphone then. He sang into an acoustical horn. And if he was making a record at that stage, he'd have to sing that same record, that same song, 100 times maybe, to make 100 copies.
Yeah.
And he'd have to go back to the studio day after day, and that was really hard work. He might sing that one song maybe 30 times on the first session.
Yeah.
And that was really tremendous hard work for a tenor.
You know a lot to have the Brazilian people on the show.
I was listening. It was very, very interesting indeed.
You may have heard them saying that Don Orti, the producer, who was mentioning the comparison between the Brazilian group that he had with him here in comparison to, say, British or Irish group or American group. And he said that the Brazilians still have a great pride in their work, and they go back every day, every afternoon, to the Gaiety Theatre, and they rehearse and rehearse and rehearse.
Yeah.
And whereas the other groups from, say, this part of the world, they just don't have the dedication or the... I don't know, maybe the talent isn't there, but they don't have the dedication, certainly.
Well, obviously, the Brazilian group is totally after perfection.
Yeah.
And to achieve a certain sort of perfection that they have shown in their production, it proves that they really must have rehearsed a tremendous amount of time.
Yes.
I mean, a lot of other groups today, as you say, they just come on and do their bit at night.
Yeah.
And that's it. They might have one rehearsal within a fortnight to brush up a weak point.
So it shows the difference between the professional and the amateur.
Oh,
really,
yes. I mean, absolute dedication was shown by the Brazilian group.
Getting back to the Mario Lanza and Caruso, why is it, would you say, that the Italians seem to produce so many well-famous singers?
I don't know, really. I think they're just a very musical nation, because the Italians seem to do a great deal of singing, even during their normal working periods.
Yeah.
You know, they're just a very musical nation, and I don't know why they always produce such wonderful tenors.
Yeah.
Because all the good tenors come from Italy.
Yeah, well, is it something that you would say that they're brought up with? Are the children taught to appreciate that sort of music?
Yes, I think they're brought into music from a very early age. They're taught singing and various musical instruments.
Yeah.
More so, maybe, than other countries.
Yes.
They're a very musical nation, no doubt about that.
I remember I had a very funny incident in London a few years ago. There was two Italians, and they were walking through the tube station in Bond Street, and they had earphones on them, and the transistor radios.
Yeah.
And they were going along, clipping their fingers and dancing.
Yeah.
And when they went along to give the ticket to the lady who was collecting, they simply took the earphones off, put them onto her, started dancing around the tube station with her. And there was no talking, just she was enjoying it like them.
Yeah.
It was an incredible experience, and it seems to be typical Italian, you know?
Yeah.
If you do the same thing here, people would be shocked.
Oh, they definitely
Yeah.
But they really bring music into their work.
Yes, yeah. I tell you what, we're going to take a little break for some more music now, Tony.
Okay, Eric.
That was So Long, So Long, Susie Baby by Black Lace. How do you like that sort of music, Tony?
Well, I do like some of it, Eric. I don't like all of it, you know?
Yes.
I like a record that has a definite good lyric to it.
Yeah. Do you feel a lot of these very latest records are just...
I feel a lot of the latest ones, they just don't appeal at all.
Yeah. Of modern singers and modern, say, musicians, have you any particular favourites?
Oh, I have, yes. I like... In fact, I like anything that Sinatra sings.
Yeah.
I think he's really a wonderful artist. I mean, he's been going now for such a great many years and is retired and come back out of retirement.
Yes.
I mean, that's the same as Bing Crosby. He's a legend, of course. Bing Crosby.
Yeah. I know watching Sinatra, he's got a certain style of his own that nobody follow up, really, has he? He's very smooth,
absolutely
professional.
Smooth. You'll never even see him take a breath.
No. And these people don't get their reputations for nothing, really, do they?
They don't, Eric, no.
Yeah.
No, they're just masters of the business, and I don't think anybody can really say that there's anybody better than them, because they've held the popularity for such a long time.
Yes. And, of course, there are so many imitations along the way, aren't
there? Oh, there is, yes.
Yeah. Are the two of those, did you have a particular choice yourself, Bing, or Sinatra?
I would take Sinatra any day.
Yeah, yeah. What qualities would you say he had over Bing?
Well, I find that he's very easy to listen to, and probably the art of singing, he has a greater art in an easy portrayal of the song he's putting over, more so even than Bing.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to express, I suppose. I mean, they're both crooners.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Sinatra has a greater power, more power than Bing ever had.
Even as an individual, I think he was stronger as well,
yes,
wasn't he?
Yes.
His acting ability, of course, is tremendous. I mean, he never had an acting lesson, did he?
He hadn't, and I've seen many films of Sinatra, and he was absolutely perfect in every part he played.
Yes. And, of course, I don't know if you've ever read his biography, did you?
I didn't, no.
A tremendous book. It's he had so many setbacks along the way, and he made a million and lost his million and made his millions back again,
that's,
you know?
That's right, yes.
Tremendous man, really.
And a real gambler, too.
Oh, yes.
In a big way.
Yes. And, of course, then getting back to your saying about John McCormack, people saying that he was a mean man and so forth, well, the reputation Sinatra has, I mean, they either seem to hate him or love him, don't they?
That's it, yes.
Yeah.
And he, too, is a charitable man, because he does a great amount of concerts solely for charity.
Oh, yes.
I mean, the sort of money that his concert would bring in would really mean a tremendous amount to any charitable organisation who would be on the receiving end.
And he's one man, of course, of all the singers, he's one man you can guarantee will pack any place.
You can.
Yeah.
I mean, we couldn't afford him here in Dublin, unfortunately.
Mm.
If we had the Theatre Royal back in Dublin, I'd say we could afford him. that's another terrible shame that we haven't got a theatre big enough to be able to accommodate some of these great people.
Yeah. Well, would you say now that Roy was back again that it could be fully used and fully accommodated?
Yes, I just think that was a very bad blunder taking it away. It's just a case of greed. They expected the office block that's there now in its place would break big, take a bigger return in money over a certain number of years, I suppose. But the Roy, if we had it today, I think it would be very well supported.
Yeah.
It reminds me of many other things we lost, and there were stories for what they did, like the Harper Street Bray railway line, if I may switch to that.
Yes.
If we had that today, it would be very well supported.
Yeah.
And it's a bit late now to think of having it, because the cost of reinstating it would be so great.
I see there was talk in the paper the other day about doing away with railways altogether, wasn't there?
Indeed, I saw that, but that was a thought that I don't think could be a reality, because, I mean, just the roads today, as I always say, most of what you see on the roads today should be on the railways.
Yes.
You see these tremendous monsters on the road.
Mm-hmm.
And in years gone by, when the railways were at full power, those great monsters would be on the railways.
Yes.
And we had so many branch lines, but now there are so few branch lines left, they have no other alternative for you to put them on the road. So if we lost the railways completely, we would have no roads to cope with the terrible traffic that would be trying to get on them.
Pretty false economy in the long run, isn't it?
That's what it must be. Surely.
Yes.
I mean, if the railways were run properly, they would be a proposition, surely.
Yeah. Came back to the theatre, of course, again. I had Noel Press on the show a few weeks ago as well, and he was stating that fact about it was such a big theatre. It held something like 3,500, 4,000 people.
It was a 4,000 theatre, Eric.
Bigger than the Palladium, even.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
It had four balconies.
Yes.
And a tremendous auditorium. And, I mean, they could stage practically, no matter how big the production was, there was no problem to the Theatre Royal.
Yeah.
And they had an excellent projection room. They had always a very good film to run with the variety show on stage.
Mm.
And, I mean, all the best people played there over the years.
Yeah,
and anyone you could mention.
Had a lot of history attached to it, really, hadn't
it? Oh, dear. I mean, Joe McCormack himself sang there in 1935. The scenery they used.
Yeah.
You would see their Christmas pantomime always run into March and April, longer than any other theatre in Dublin. And the settings were absolutely fantastic. They used to have waterfalls on stage, and looking at them, you would really imagine that they were real.
Yeah.
They were mechanically produced. And they went in for all sorts of lavish things like that on stage.
I think pantomime nowadays could never compare with those, really, could they? I mean,
never could. No.
Even the way they dress the artists, I'd say, even simple things like custom boots and all, I mean, but they're not, the same reality isn't there any longer.
No, the illusion is gone, I think, from good pantomime.
Would you say this is because of the modern age of television or anything like that? Would you say that's the story?
Yes, I think so. It probably is, yes.
Mm.
I don't think the real work goes into the actual production.
Yeah.
That used to go in.
Yes.
During the war years in Dublin, where we hadn't got any overseas artists coming here at all, we all depended on home artists all the time.
Yeah.
And it was fantastic that the production they were able to put on, even though materials were scarce, they always were able to come up with wonderful settings for the various productions that would be produced.
Possibly the introduction of, say, of television and cabaret and all has changed a lot, has it?
Well, you see, at that time we hadn't such things as television.
Yes.
And the whole theatre performance was really worth looking at during those days.
Yeah.
Whether
it
was a play or a pantomime or just a variety show.
Yes.
They really went into it wholeheartedly.
Yeah. So there again, getting back to the old story, like the Brazilian group, nobody's doing anything in it to the professional capacity anymore.
No, not in the same light, Eric, no.
Tell you what, we're going to take another break for some music, Tony, and I'd like you to introduce the next record, which is a favourite of yours, obviously, as well.
Yes, I'll do that, certainly, Eric. The next record is a very great favourite of mine. It goes way back to, I suppose, 1938, I think, around that year. And it's written by Canon Sidney McEwan. In earlier years, he was known as Father Sidney McEwan. He was upgraded to Canon many years ago, and this was a very, very popular record. I remember, not too many years ago, on the Radio Éireann Request programme on a Monday, when we had Hospice Request, this was one record we'll be asked for quite often.
Yeah.
And the title is Sweetly She Sleeps by Alice Fair. It's a Scots song.
problem there, do we? Is it coming, Tony? Okay, we'll come back to it in a moment, okay? Right, we seem to have a problem. Once again, you're listening to the Eric Peters Chat Show. My very special guest this evening is Tony Boylan. I apologize for the slight breakdown in the playing the record for Tony there, called Sweetly She Sleeps, My Alice Fair by Canon Sidney McCune. And I think Tony Lawrence now has the tape ready to play. Okay, Tony? And we'll play it now, okay?
Very great favourite indeed, Eric,
yes. I think we've got another bit of music coming in the background there, haven't we?
That's going.
I hope we're not going to have another repeat of last week. We had three breakdowns.
Which will happen the best.
Of course.
On national radio, etc.
The point is we have to just move along with it, haven't we?
Yes, it even happens on television quite
often. This is it, yes. You sometimes see the camera on somebody else and the wrong guy sitting there, you know.
So
you just move along with it, you know. Getting back to Commander Ray, how many records have you got altogether, Tony?
Well, altogether, I mean, I have them categorised, 78, I suppose, about 6,500, approximately.
That's a lot of records.
Well, they take up a terrible lot of space, you know, to file them properly, they need all to be standing on the edges and indexed properly, which I haven't got only half of them indexed.
Yes.
In case you're getting the time to do it, Eric.
Yes, of course.
And LPs, about 600. Singles, 45s, about 1,100, that's about it.
Yeah.
I'm still collecting.
So now, when you say still collecting, do you sort of collect old records, or do you buy new records that come out, or what? What does it mean?
Well, I buy LPs if I see transfers from old 78s. You get a lot of old 78s being transferred by certain important artists. Quite a lot nowadays.
Yes.
And if the transfers are well done, they're well worth buying. Mm. Because they're able to eliminate a lot of the needle scratch that you get on a direct 78.
Yes.
And even a 78, when it's new, you will still get a fair amount of needle scratch.
Yeah. So the transfer...
They're able to filter it out to a great degree nowadays. I'd say you lose about half of it.
Yes. Do they at times reissue some of these old records?
Oh, the old ones? Yes.
Yes. Will this be by public demand or what?
No, the record company just digs out a certain amount of old masters by various singers that they could think would have a market today, and they repress them.
Yes.
Under some obscure label maybe that you wouldn't think about, and they would see how they go.
How many were they print at a time when they did these?
Oh, they would print probably about 100,000.
I suppose they're snapped up straight away, aren't they?
Well, if the artist is good, like, if it's somebody, a good singer from the past, they will always sell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because people today, the younger generation, may never have heard that particular artist.
Yeah.
When you consider the 78s, they stopped making them about 1953.
Yes.
And they were no longer available in the shops here in this country.
Yeah.
So people that have been born after 1953 really missed a great deal of these great singers that have been around for so long.
Yeah.
And if they reproduce these records nowadays in LPs or singles, well, they've been heard for the first time.
Yeah. What is the reaction of young people when they hear some of these records?
Well, I think that sometimes they're favourably impressed. Mm. I've heard many people who have heard stuff on my programme on Sunday morning say, they like the stuff very much, although, and I would think of them, I'd say, oh, you wouldn't be bothered, that's not your kind of music, and I'm very often wrong.
Yeah.
They do like certain of the artists from way back.
Yeah, I think...
I've never heard.
It's a fallacy probably saying the young people don't like them, because I remember, say, going back about 10, 12 years ago, and I remember the special show of Cliff Richard coming on television, and he's a favourite of mine. And I remember before it came on, they had a programme of Flanagan and Allen.
Oh, yes.
And I remember I watched that, and, you know, after seeing them, the enthusiasm for Cliff Richard went down, because they were so brilliant, and the music was so nice.
Yes.
And so relaxed and everything, and I think maybe a lot of young people have the same impression.
Well, Flanagan and Allen, I mean, they're really way back to the early 30s.
Yes.
And they made a great deal of records, too.
They're still going up to just... Bud Flanagan died many years ago. Not too long, but...
Not too long.
Five, six, 7 years.
I think it was 6 years ago I was there.
Yeah. He was a brilliant artist.
Absolutely, yes. And they're a great team, the pair of them.
Yes. Do you have many of their records, yeah?
I haven't a great deal, but I have some. I might have about a half a dozen.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, they were only produced on the 78th. I have never seen anything reproduced on LP by them. Now, that's the sort of artist that is likely to be reproduced at any time.
Yeah.
Because, as you say, they were so tremendous, what you've seen.
Yes.
You would certainly get an appeal for them today by the young people.
Yeah, and I think the English comedy singers, I mean, I think they had something special, hadn't they?
They had indeed. Oh, yeah. Very special, yes.
Yeah. I think... I know you're a good fan of George Formby as well, aren't you?
Well, George Formby was a very great artist, and his father before him.
Yeah.
You know, he inherited the whole thing from his father. His father was much the same as George. In fact, if you heard them one after the other, you wouldn't be able to tell who was who.
No.
I have a record, only one at home, of his father, a very old 78, an old single side, I think it's a xylophone. And unfortunately, it's in poor condition.
Yeah.
But you were thinking it was George you were listening to, not the father.
Was the father equally as famous?
Oh, yes.
But he the same name as well?
Yes.
Yeah. I see, so it was senior and junior sort of thing.
Yes, yes.
There's a, I don't know what his name is, there's a guy copies George Formby on British television.
Oh, I know what you mean. Alan Randall, yes.
He's very good as well, isn't
and
he?
I heard the two of them in succession, and I cannot tell the difference between them.
Yeah.
He's so good, he must have studied George Formby so well that you'd want to be a really an expert on George Formby, say, to tell them apart.
Mm.
I couldn't.
It's a perfect takeoff, isn't it?
Oh, an absolute perfect takeoff.
Although he must have a natural sort of singing voice like him as well.
Well, he has, and he plays the equally as good, ukulele.
Yeah. And I believe when he plays around the hall, the theatres in Britain, that they're full pector capacity as
they
well.
They are, yes. Well, I mean, all those people remember George Formby so well. I mean, George Formby was a wonderful war entertainer, like many more, like Vera Lynn, etc., entertaining the troops throughout the war years, went all over the Europe, everywhere, to where the boys were, and he entertained lavishly.
Yes.
So George today and Alan Randall taking him off so well, it would be very hard to say that he's any... that George was any better than Alan Randall, because Alan Randall, he must have made a great study of him.
So he's still living on in his image. And of course, with the old music as well, as we call it old, of course, the shows like The Good Old Days on BBC, I mean, this helps to revive them as well, doesn't it?
It does, like that music hall series from Leeds, you know.
Yes.
You'll see all these people, including, if I can think of his name now, another great entertainer. Just can't think of his name at the moment. He appears on that old-time varieties quite often.
You get quite a bit. He's the very popular artist, even now, appearing on it.
Yes, indeed you do.
And an amazing thing about that show I was reading is that there's a 2-year booking in advance to go to see it, you know, the audience.
You cannot get to see it before.
Yeah.
And the great thing about it, the artist dressed up in the old-time attire, and it really makes a great night.
Yes. People like to imagine themselves back in the old days, I suppose.
That's it, yes. And it makes a great spectacle on television, too.
Of course.
And it brings everybody back to that era.
Yeah.
And it's very well done. Arthur Askew was the man I was trying to think of. Arthur must be 80.
He's a great artist, isn't he?
I've seen him only very recently on that show.
Yeah.
And as good as ever.
And he's so fit and agile, isn't he?
Absolutely fit. There's nothing He just flits around the stage as if he was about 20.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know how he can do it, but he's in top condition.
And yet he's a man who's had a lot of suffering with his wife.
Yes, he had a hard life.
A lot of problems, yeah.
Very hard life. And yeah. I often wonder, these people, it seems to make them even better.
Yeah. I suppose the setbacks make them stronger in every way.
Even, it does too. Like Roy Orbison was another man who had a terrible, tragic life during his singing career.
Didn't he lose his wife and child or something like that? Yes.
And he came back better than ever.
Yeah.
And still making records. I mean, he's another great band.
I'm sure if he were to come tomorrow to Ireland or Britain, he'd be packed out.
He would, absolutely.
Yeah.
Great following there all the time.
I tell you what, just talking about George Formby, let's have one of his records. Maybe you'll announce the one we're going to play as well.
Yeah, sure. Well, the next one now is by our old friend George Formby. And this record was made way back in, I would think, about 1939. Auntie Maggie's Remedy, a very good number by George.
Thank you.
Now in our family we've got an heirloom. They handed it to me a year ago. It's been in our possession since Grandad was a lad. I'll tell you what it is and then you'll know. It's my Grandad's flannelette nightshirt. In it I was christened one day. Down at the church they were in the world. No one seemed to know if I were boy or girl. They'd had one or two and they were in a mess. But it's all right, said the preacher rather curt. I've been and had a quiz and I found out what it is. It's by his granddad's flannelette shirt. Lordy, lordy, his granddad's flannelette shirt. In the granddad's flannelette night shirt I got married one day. In the train my bride gave a shout. What is that you are pulling out? I said it's old-fashioned and it's tattered and torn, but I brought it honeymooning with me girl. When she said, what is it, dear? I whispered in her ear, it's me granddad's flannelette shirt. Lordy, lordy, me granddad's flannelette shirt. The other day I got an invitation to go and join a nudist colony. As the life is healthy and in the open air, I trotted off as happy as can be. With me granddad's flannelette night shirt, I walked up to the door. Someone said, now don't make a fuss, just take off your clothes and you'll be like us. I was bashful, so I stayed with myself, for with the girls I didn't want to flirt. But when I fell asleep, they all came and had a peep at me granddad's flannelette.
The great George Formby. I think we had a bit of a slip up in the name of the song there, did we, Tony?
Yeah. That's flannelette shirt.
Yes.
Well, they're much the same.
Well, we won't point our finger at anybody yet, anyway.
They're both good numbers.
Of course, they're still enjoyable, yes.
Yes, they are.
Another great favourite of yours, I know, is Jimmy Durante, isn't he?
Well, the late Jimmy Durante. He's not dead only a very short time now.
A few weeks.
And another great man. I mean, he gave up his lifetime to show business.
Yeah.
And he had a very tough life, too. In fact, towards the latter years, he was a very lonely man.
Yeah.
In fact, it's amazing the amount of acquaintances and friends you make in show business. But when he was down and sitting at home in a wheelchair watching TV night after night, nobody came to see him.
No, you'd imagine. And yet you see all these shows where they're glamorizing these people and giving them awards.
Yes.
And he was just like that, was he?
He ended up like that. Yeah. And only for the wonderful support his wife gave him throughout the last years of his life and illness, he would never have been able to take it at all.
Was his wife still alive?
His wife is still alive, and the most wonderful person he claims she was, the way she looked after him.
Yeah.
When he had absolutely nobody.
Yeah.
You know, it's a terrible thing to think of a man of his calibre and made so many films, etc., that you can be left just when you're old and become ill, nobody sort of wants you anymore.
Yeah.
That was the absolute case of Jimmy Durante.
Yeah. And was he comfortable in his life from the success point?
Oh, yes, he was very successful. I mean, money-wise, he was okay.
Yes.
I mean, he had a very brilliant career between films and recording.
Yeah. Did he, in latter years, his success still continued, or did it go down anyway along the way?
Well, like, for a great many years, he hadn't been making records.
Yeah.
I would say that's a long time. I would say he probably didn't produce a record in some 20 years ago. Would have been the last one.
But he still probably made public appearances, I suppose.
Oh, he did. Yes, he did some concerts when he was able.
Yeah, yeah.
But he had a lot of ill health for a good many years.
Yeah.
And he was in and out of hospital, and he ended up by being sort of confined to a wheelchair. He finally got pneumonia, and that really killed him eventually.
What magic would you say these people had that gave them such lasting fame?
What magic? Well, Jimmy Durante, I mean, there was only one Jimmy Durante. Like other greats, you'll never hear anybody take their place. And I think that speaks great for a man when you think, well, there was only one of them, and there's nobody absolutely copying him,
yeah,
or trying to be as good as him.
Mm-hmm.
You get a lot of people copying Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra, although they never come anywhere near them.
No.
But like Jimmy Durante, I never heard anybody even try to be as good as him.
Yeah, yeah.
He had his own particular style.
Yeah.
And that hoarse type of voice that he always seemed to have, and that great great humour in his character.
Mm.
You know, he was always happy when he was performing.
Of course,
he always sounded happy.
His nose was his gimmick as well.
That's right, his nose was his gimmick, yes.
Yeah.
One particular record he made of It's My Nose's Birthday Today.
Yeah.
That was a very famous one.
Yes, yes.
And, of course, he made so many records, I could only remember some of them.
Now, was he Jewish or Italian? What was he?
I think he was Jewish.
Yeah, with a nose like that. No offence to any Jews.
Oh, no, but he was Jewish as far as I know.
Yes, yes. But he was a great entertainer, wasn't he?
Wonderful entertainer.
Yeah.
And he played piano very well, too.
Yeah. Maybe at this time it's opportune to play one of his records.
Yes,
maybe you'll announce
right.
The one we're going to play.
Well, I picked one of his best, and it's I'm the Guy Who Found the Lost Chord.
Sitting at my piano the other day, my mind was still at ease. They were coming to take it away that afternoon. I was all by myself in a mellow mood, improvising symphonies. My right hand was playing Mozart's Minuet, and at the same time, the left hand was playing Have a Banana from Carmen. And at the same time, my mouth was whistling a sextet from Luigini. And while all this was going on, what do you think my foot was doing? While keeping time, it was cracking walnuts. You see, I had to eat too. Then in the midst of my soliloquy, a strange feeling came over me. My right hand stopped playing, my left hand stopped playing, my mouth stopped whistling, and my foot stopped cracking walnuts. Food became secondary. Why? Because, ladies and gentlemen, I found it. I found it. The lost chord. That's it, the lost chord. So let's celebrate. I'm feeling great. I'm the guy who found the lost chord. That's it, it hasn't changed. I'll have my name in the Hall of Fame, 'cause I went and found the lost chord. Now everyone knows Tchaikovsky wasn't recognized for 200 years. Brahms wasn't recognized for 300 years. Beethoven wasn't recognized for 400 years. But I can't wait that long. I've got only two changes of clothes.
The late Jimmy Durante. I wasn't aware, Tony, that Jack Dorn and Movita had made records together. Had they made a few, yes?
Well, they didn't make many altogether, Eric. They made about 3 78s, double-sided 78s. That's a total of 6 sides. And unfortunately, that was in the 30s, and today they're sort of like gold dust. I haven't got them all, I've only got 2 of them.
Well, is there quite a command for his records, you know?
Well,
his or the 2 of them together,
With collectors, there would be, yes.
Yeah. How would you class him as a singer?
Well, Jeff Doyle started off very well, and as a tenor, he made a very good start. And had he continued on singing, he would have really gone places.
He started off, obviously, as a boxer, first of all.
He did, yes.
Yeah, and this led to his singing, I suppose,
that's
as well.
Right, yes, and he was trying to do both.
Yeah.
And he ended up by doing neither as well.
This is the problem, isn't it? Not doing one thing well.
He boxed like Joe McCormack.
And what did he sing like?
Well, he sang very well. This particular recording that I brought along tonight,
Yes.
His one with his wife, Movita, at that time, first wife, she joined them, and she was very nice too. And they appeared in the Theatre Royal before World War II.
Yes.
I'm not sure the year. It could be 1937 or 1938. And they sing this particular song there with many other songs.
Yeah.
On stage, and got a tremendous response.
Was the... one hears a lot about the glamour of the two of them. Would you say it was the actual glamour or their talent combined? What would you think?
Well, I think a bit of both. I mean, he's a tremendous man for glamour and dressing up. More so, I'd say, than Movita.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, Jack just wants to be around the best places, dressed to the nines and drinking and enjoying himself, and that was delightful.
Was he as good-looking as they say?
Oh, he was. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Very good-looking. And, I mean, built proportionally, and about 6'6", I suppose.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, Movita beside him, she looked very tiny.
It's a shame all the same when you hear about these people, the way they wasted the talent as well.
Terrible shame, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, they were very happy there in the initial stages when they were married.
Yeah.
And even when they appeared in the Royal, they went down very well and seemed terribly happy.
What would you say was the cause of the breakup? Did you think it was...
Well, he just went... he went to the fair with drinking, etc. That's all.
It's a very similar situation to the likes of George Best, really.
It is, yes. Much the same.
Very.
I mean, had he not been drinking, he would have had a very good career ahead of him, I would say.
Yeah. How far did he get in his boxing career?
Oh, he didn't really get far at all.
No, he didn't find anything very big, then, did
he? No, he didn't, no.
So you feel if he had left his boxing to one side and concentrated on his singing, he would have made a good...
He would have got on pretty well now with the singing. Because he had a make-up of a very nice lyrical tenor voice.
Yeah. And I remember seeing him on documentary on television. You may have seen it a year or two ago.
I did. I saw that particular one, yes. He was in London.
Yeah, I must admire one thing. Even though he had been down so much, he still had pride in himself to a certain extent, didn't he?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and he still had a certain amount of optimism as well.
Absolutely, yes. He always was willing to talk about the old days, etc., and the days ahead of him. I saw his wife, his first wife, Movita, recently on television, a couple of weeks ago.
I saw that she was being interviewed
on one of the RTE,
yeah, yeah.
I can't remember the interviewer now who it was.
Yeah.
But it was very interesting, too. She talked about Jack and the old days and how happy she is today in California.
Yeah.
Seems to be well fixed money-wise, etc. She married
Marlon Brando afterwards, didn't
she? Oh, she did, yes. But she's not married to anybody now.
Yeah. Although I think both Marlon Brando and Jack Doyle both insisted that she was still their wife.
Oh, they did.
Yeah. She must have been very popular indeed. She must have had something.
Oh, she must have had, yes. Yeah. She still looked a fine-looking woman as she appeared on TV there. I was very much surprised. I expect her to look much older.
Yeah, well, what age would she be about?
I suppose she would be about 54.
Yes.
Or 5.
Yeah.
But she didn't look it.
But they were quite a glamorous couple, as you say.
Oh, indeed they were. Very glamorous. She had a great gypsy appearance about her in the old days when I first saw her in the Theatre Royal. She really was a lovely girl with flowing long black hair way down her back.
Yes.
And of course Jack was the greatest at that time.
Yes. Well, I think it's once again appropriate to play one of the records. Maybe you'll introduce the record you brought along. I'd like to also point out to some of the listeners that some of the music Tony has brought along are 78 records, and the quality may not be up to some of the present day music. So perhaps, Tony, you can introduce the next one.
Thank you, Eric. Well, the next one I have chosen by Jack Doyle and his first wife Movita, singing South of the Border in have a duet, and very nicely I think they do it too.
Mexico way. It was a peace
realize he had such a good voice, Tony?
Well, I think it really shows up in that recording of South of the Border.
Yeah.
I mean, his Irish brogue comes through very well there, too, you might have noticed.
Yes.
But he certainly had the makings of a nice lyrical tenor.
Yeah, he spent quite a while in America, I suppose, as well, did he?
Oh, he did, yes.
Yeah, they probably raved about the Irish.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Jack hit all the night spots and had a good time.
Yes.
He was very good at that.
Yeah. And I know another favourite of yours, of course, is Richard Crooks, isn't that right?
Yes, the American tenor, Richard Crooks.
Yeah.
Dead a many good many years now.
Yes.
But he was another very great man.
Yeah.
In the
his style of singing was on par with who, would you say now?
Well, he was about in par with Hedel Nash and such people as I would think Hedel Nash and probably yes, Tauber, I was trying to think of.
That'd be Richard Tauber,
yes. Yeah. He was classified in that category with Hedel Nash and Richard Tauber.
I see, yes, yeah.
As one of the greats.
As one of the greats, yeah. What about, I put his name right, but is it Yoshi Björling, is it?
Yoshi Björling. Yeah, well, he is, of course, Italian.
Yeah.
He's a very famous Italian tenor, too. Sorry, Jussi Björling is not, he's Swedish.
Swedish, yeah.
My tenor's mixed up.
Yes.
Well, he's a tremendous favourite too nowadays.
Even now, it's just still a very big name.
Very big name. Well, yeah. Quite often, on the 78 show on a Sunday morning, I've got a request in for anything by him.
Yeah. You know, you've been running your show for many years now. Is there any particular type of singers you feel you get more requests for than others?
Yes, I do get more requests for John McCormack, Richard Crooks, and Geely, John Charles Thomas, which we have here tonight.
Yes.
Nearly repeatedly these people come up, and Richard Tauber, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose because, well, they're not being heard at all, except for certain shows that are on the radio, like Tommy O'Brien's show, Your Choice and Mine, and the Liam Devalley show on a Sunday morning.
Yeah.
And that's it. If you don't hear them on those shows, you never hear them at all.
So those are the only two shows that would compare with yours in the type of music, really?
True, yes.
Yeah. How long have they been running those shows? Tommy O'Brien's quite a well-known name.
I don't know, many years, but Tommy O'Brien is running a good many years now, always on a Tuesday night.
Yeah.
And very well worth listening to.
Yeah.
Although Tommy is mainly operatic, but then he plays requests for any of these people.
Yes.
And Tommy has a very big library, too, down in Clonmel.
Yeah. I was reading about him in the paper as well, that he said that to him it's a hobby as well as...
Oh yes, music is Tommy's hobby. I mean, Tommy went to opera from the time he was at school, and he went to practically every opera that ever was to be seen in his country, and Covent Garden over in England.
Yeah.
London, and I don't think you could trip Tommy up if he comes talking about opera.
Yes.
He's a real authority on opera.
Well, even yourself, I mean, you obviously know a lot of information about all these.
Well, mine is a very mixed bag, and my information is very limited, Eric, towards some people. I don't specialise in any one artist.
Yeah.
I try to just know a little about as many of them as I can.
Yeah. But it's basically a hobby with you, music.
Oh, sure, it's an absolute hobby, yes.
Yes.
Starting way back in 1935 was the first record I ever got.
Yeah, so the bug hit you then.
Oh, it did, yes.
Yeah.
Well, I still have that particular record, and I have played it on the 78 show even twice.
Have you, That's one that'd be, how old would that be?
Well, 45
years.
That's what I have quit calculations.
Yes.
Almost over 40 years, isn't it?
Yeah, 45 years.
Yes, 45 years.
Yeah.
Same record was bought at Walbert for the princely sum of one and sixpence.
Yeah. I suppose nowadays it'd be fetching what?
Well, record today, you won't buy a record now if it's a single, it's around £1, isn't it?
Yes, about, I think it's the cheapest one you get.
It's the cheapest one you'll get. Well, I suppose, I think of the wages nowadays and the wages then.
Yeah.
1/6 at that time, 1935, was a fair amount of money.
Yes, yeah. I think they all balance out in the end, don't
they?
Really
do, yeah.
You sometimes hear people saying, well, in those days it was this and that, but
it's the same.
Very small. Equal all round, yes.
I mean, I've got to think back to my first job, and that gives me a comparison.
Yes.
My first job was in 1942. I was paid 16 bob a week, and I thought I was doing great.
That you were rich.
I was considered great, John. I could do a lot of that 16 bob.
Yeah.